This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on the program, another temporary ceasefire between Israel and armed groups in Gaza quickly collapses. U.S. lawmakers are still unable to agree on an immigration enforcement bill. And a delegation from Canada's Grassy Narrows First Nation demands action after 50 years of mercury poisoning. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Israel's military offensive in the Gaza Strip enters its fourth week. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, nearly 1,500 Palestinians have been killed, the vast majority civilians, many of them women and children. More than 60 Israelis are dead, nearly all of them soldiers. FSRN's Rami Amagari reports that a temporary ceasefire, which took effect early Friday, collapsed within hours, with an Israeli soldier captured and dozens more Palestinians reportedly dead in Rafah.
The Islamist Hamas party accuses Israel of breaching the 72-hour truce mediated by the U.S. and UN, saying the Israeli army killed 40 residents and injured 200 others in southern Rafah city. Israel says an army officer was captured during a Hamas raid on a group of soldiers near Rafah. Hamas denies any involvement and has delayed its delegation's travel for talks until tomorrow, accusing Israel of violating the mediated truce. But during the brief lull, people here were very active on the streets. Some looked for some foodstuffs to store. Others checked on the homes they fled. Many inspected the damage to houses, facilities or factories, saving what they could dig from the rubble. Iyad Al-Tilbani is the manager of the 1.5-acre Al-Awda wafer and ice cream factory in the central Gaza Strip town of Deir al-Balah. The factory is owned by Iyad's father, Muhammad Al-Tilbani, a key businessman in the occupied coastal territory. Iyad estimates his damages at $20 million.
The whole factory was destroyed. Raw materials like wheat, sugar, butter, packaging, nothing is left.
The factory is but one of many places that formerly provided work for many local residents. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
More than 5,000 homes have been destroyed in the Gaza Strip, leaving the captive population dependent on UN shelters, which have also come under attack. On Wednesday, the Israeli military shelled a UN-run elementary school in the Jabalia refugee camp, which was providing shelter to more than 3,000 Gazans. The attack killed at least 15 people. It was the sixth time a UN shelter in Gaza was targeted in the context of the ongoing offensive. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called it a reprehensible attack. According to the Secretary General, Israel was notified of the shelter's coordinates 17 times. UN Humanitarian Affairs Chief John Ging disputed any possible claims that armed factions used the facility to store weapons.
No school that has been sheltering people or has been under the UN's control have there been weapons found in while under the UN's control. So again, there is no excuse to say that there are weapons in these schools when they are being used as shelters or under the UN's control.
Protests, both popular and political, continue across the U.S. and around the world. El Salvador became the fifth Latin American country to recall envoys to Israel. Police used tear gas to quell protests in India. And in Toronto, demonstrators told FSRN why they were in the streets.
From a human point of view, to start with, it's hard to watch children dying. And being a parent, when I see those pictures of children, it's an enormous thing to take in and not feel like you need to do something about it. So that's why.
I'm marching because no one should really be hurting Palestine. The Israeli government are shooting bombs at Palestine.
I'm in solidarity with Gaza because there are terrible war crimes going on, even as we speak. Innocent people are being killed by the scores every day. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. And the world is silent, basically.
Well, if you look at the numbers, you can clearly tell that the Gaza people are the ones who are getting hurt and not the Israelis. And based on the military forces, Gaza doesn't have anything. And Israel has a huge military base that's supported by the U.S. and other Western countries. And so that's why I support Gaza. And it's just like, it's a humanitarian issue, and I feel like they're getting hurt for no reason.
It's a terrible situation all around for Israel as well as for Gaza. It's but, you know, sure, Israel has the right to defend itself, but not to do a collective punishment on the people of Gaza. It's sending in massive forces and bombardment, and they're primarily killing innocent civilians. So that's why I stand in solidarity with it.
I think it's basic human rights. Like, it's occupation, it's colonialism. This, you know, they're trying to settle in an area that's actually illegal by international law. There's just so many reasons, and I mean, it's all propaganda, I think, in terms of what the Israeli government is saying and what they're actually doing. Like, in alternative media, you'll hear and see pictures and stories about what really is going on. There's demonstrations happening in Israel, you know, with thousands of people that disagree with their own government's actions. And how can you not support Gaza?
On Thursday, a group of 35 U.S. senators, led by Democrat Barbara Boxer, condemned a United Nations Human Rights Council decision to launch a probe into possible war crimes committed by Israel in Gaza, calling it one-sided, as the mandate does not include a review of Hamas activities during the conflict. Israel is the top recipient of U.S. military aid, spending which Congress controls. A congressional standoff about emergency funding to handle the influx of migrant children fleeing rampant poverty and violence in Central America continues. A GOP bill in the House failed yesterday when far-right lawmakers withheld support because the package didn't cancel the Deferred Action Program. Deferred action gives temporary legal status to so-called Dreamers, or immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. In a last-minute scramble before recess, House Republicans were trying to push through a now nearly $700 million package that would provide funds to hold the kids through next month, hurry deportations, and freeze deferred action. The bill is a far cry from its counterpart in the Senate, a nearly $3 billion bill, which included things like money for Israel and funds for wildland firefighting. When that bill stalled, the Senate extracted and unanimously approved the additional military aid for Israel. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of unaccompanied children are on the move again to so-called foster care, where they await deportation. Recent data from the Office of Refugee Resettlement shows 85% of them have been released to close relatives, mainly in states with high Latino populations like Texas, New York, Florida, and California. Another 10% have been placed into what officials call foster care across the U.S. But as Ashley Westerman reports from Washington, D.C., the definition of foster care is open to interpretation.
Almost 5,000 unaccompanied migrant children have been released to family members in the Washington, D.C. metro area. They're among 30,000 such youth housed nationwide since the beginning of the year. That's according to the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement, the government agency also placing children into temporary foster care facilities around the U.S. At a panel discussion hosted earlier this week by the Bipartisan Policy Center's Immigration Task Force, Director of the Migrant Rights and Justice Women's Refugee Commission, Michelle Brunet, said the demographics of youth crossing the border have changed. She says the average age of unaccompanied migrants is trending down to 14, and more girls are crossing the border.
And that means that we see many, many children who are 6, 7, 8, 10-year-olds are not uncommon, and even younger. So it really is a different population, I think, than what traditionally has come in over the years.
Brene says while the Office of Refugee Resettlement tries to reunite kids with their own families, what the federal government calls foster care for young children is a viable alternative to a detention center-like setting.
Right, I mean, you can't put a baby in that sort of a setting. So obviously foster care is a much better option for the younger children or for children who are particularly vulnerable.
However, very few typical foster families are approved to host these children, so they're housed in congregate living settings such as revamped schools or other large buildings, settings much different from what some might typically think of as a foster home. Brene says all of the services provided for children in immigration custody, including immigration foster care, are completely covered by the federal government. That means all services for these kids, medical care, food, safety, social services, and education, comes out of the Department of Health and Human Services budget. Jennifer Podkuhl, also with the Women's Refugee Commission, says this so-called short-term foster care is one of four programs the federal government uses to house refugees. She says they would like to see the government rely on this program more because it provides additional services.
They use a lot of shelters or secure shelters to house the children. But when I have done monitoring visits and I've seen how these foster placements work, they're really great, and they're great in dealing with a population that's so traumatized as many of these kids are.
Podkuhl says states like Maryland, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Delaware that come forward and say they are happy to house migrant children don't have to pay anything for them to be there. She also notes that while awaiting deportation proceedings in these so-called foster settings, the children remain segregated.
So although these children are located in the state, they actually rarely even leave the facilities that they're in. So the local communities rarely have interaction with these populations.
Podkuhl adds that the federal program should not be confused with state-run foster care systems or the unaccompanied refugee minor program, which can both serve immigrant children but have nothing to do with the tens of thousands of kids fleeing Central America and the resulting humanitarian crisis at the border.
These short-term foster programs are only designed to hold the child and to house the child while the child's in their deportation proceedings.
Custom and Border Protection stats predict that 72,000 unaccompanied children will cross into the U.S. by the end of 2014. And while the number has increased dramatically over the past 5 years, it's still not as high as pre-recession levels. Ashley Westerman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You'll find more of our work, along with information about how you can support it, at fsrn.org. A delegation from Ontario's Grassy Narrows First Nation traveled to Toronto this week. 50 years ago, a massive amount of mercury was dumped in their water supply, and they've suffered ever since. They say the government has ignored their needs, and they're demanding action. Aaron Hudson reports from Toronto.
More than 50 years ago, a paper mill dumped 20,000 pounds of mercury into the river system surrounding the homelands of Canada's Grassy Narrows First Nation. Ever since, the people downstream have suffered the effects of mercury poisoning, including tremors and loss of muscular and sensory control. Grassy's former chief, Steve Faubister, is in constant pain due to his exposure to mercury.
You lose your coordination, your speech, and you die, and your body breaks down one piece at a time. It's very painful.
He staged a hunger strike this week demanding government action. He described some of the effects of mercury poisoning.
What compelled me was to go on a hunger strike was a young woman came to me, barely 20 years old. He had a son who was 1 year old and had developed seizures 6 times a day. Imagine.
The details of how more than 2,000 were poisoned were kept quiet as part of a 1985 out-of-court settlement between Grassy and the Ontario and Canadian governments. The settlement established an independent mercury disability board to provide adequate health care and dispense compensation. According to a report commissioned by the board in 2009, the care and compensation being provided isn't enough. The report admonishes the Canadian and Ontario governments for their conscious inaction, high burden of proof for affected residents seeking compensation, and for those who do receive compensation, the comparatively small amount awarded. The report was quietly released in 2010. So quietly, many Grassy residents, many of whom are living with disabilities caused by the mercury, didn't even know it existed until this spring, including current chief Roger Faubister.
Being a new chief and being the head of the Grassneros government, I take the matter of mercury pollution seriously. So when that report was mentioned, and you know, we decided that well, let's take this report and talk about it with the government of Ontario.
The board's chairperson told media that a briefing on the report was given to Grassy's board representatives and a community meeting was held. The Ontario Minister of Aboriginal Affairs plans to visit Grassy next week and says he intends to launch an investigation of the board. About 30 Grassy residents are in Toronto this week to stage a series of protests. They're demanding an apology and want the Ontario government to accept responsibility, to provide adequate compensation, and to ensure quality health care for those affected. They also want the polluted river system cleaned up and are calling for a moratorium on clear-cut logging on their territory. The largest action plan for this week is a river run protest, where demonstrators will personify a river marching towards the Ontario legislature. Erin Hudson, FSRN, Toronto.
For the past three decades, the Kurdish rebel group the PKK has led an armed struggle against Turkey, fighting for greater minority rights. But in a peace process during the past few years, the rebel group called a ceasefire. Now those efforts are under threat because of controversial military construction projects across Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast. The program comes as peace efforts remain stalled. In a skirmish this week, three Turkish soldiers and six rebels were killed. And as Dorian Jones reports, the controversy has provoked mutual recriminations and fatal protests.
Lice, in southeast Turkey, is where the first shots were fired 30 years ago in the conflict between the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, and the Turkish state. But peace has returned to these lands, thanks to a government-initiated peace process with the rebels. Now that process is under threat. Ahmed doesn't want to give his full name, for fear of being targeted by the authorities. But he shows me the place where earlier this month, a peaceful protest against the construction of a military base nearby turned deadly.
This is where our friend Ramazan was shot. We've marked the place with stones, but you can still see the blood. It happened around 6 in the evening. It was a crowded protest. There were mothers, elderly people, people of all ages. They were protesting against the new military bases and dams. The army was shooting to kill. There was no warning, no pepper gas, no gas bombs before they shot. They directly shot at people, directly. People came here for a democratic protest and they were killed.
Two people died that day, causing outrage among many Kurds. Other demonstrations in towns and cities across the region turned violent. Several soldiers are now under investigation for the shootings. These killings have focused attention on the construction of large, sophisticated military bases, which have been built almost exclusively across the predominantly Kurdish region. The bases are much larger than previous built ones and are equipped with state-of-the-art weapons and electronic sensors. According to state figures, 114 have already been built and 166 are under construction. The government insists the building program is just about renewing old bases, but protests are still continuing against these military outposts. With the peace process stalled, some Kurdish rights activists are increasingly questioning the sincerity of the government. As this protester explains,
these military bases are places of death. They're a place of evil, not of goodness. If Prime Minister Erdogan is interested in our well-being and loves us, why isn't he building factories, hospitals, and schools here? Then we can call him the Prime Minister of Turkey and be sure that he's not discriminating against us. But we don't have any trust or hope left.
The distrust goes both ways. The ruling AK party is also questioning the intentions of the PKK, accusing the rebels of taking advantage of the peace process. Fatma Unchu is a member of the AK party's National Committee. She defends the military building program.
In many places, the bases are simply being upgraded because our security forces are inhabiting these posts and they're run down. The aim is not to create a war situation. What was the peace process built on? The first condition was the disarmament and for the guerrillas to leave Turkey for their bases in Iraq. But not even 20% of the PKK militants have returned to their bases.
But in a move to try and defuse tensions, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan introduced into Parliament a bill to enhance the peace process. It includes formalizing the peace process and opening the door to the release of six PKK prisoners, both key demands of the rebel group. The package is well-timed, as many Kurds appear to be losing patience with the situation. The future of the military building program is seen as an important test of the government's commitment to peace. Surasuriye Önder is a parliamentary deputy of the pro-Kurdish HDP and a key member of the current peace efforts. Speaking to him at a Kurdish rights rally in Diyarbakir, he says the military construction program has to end.
Asking for peace and then building military bases constitutes the biggest contradiction in the world. There are thousands of things to be done socially, culturally, and economically in the region. The government is giving a message that it wants peace, but building these military bases is the very opposite of that message. It's an oxymoron.
Önder, speaking at a mass demonstration in Diyarbakir, the main city here, promised that if the peace process continues, the PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan, who's been in prison for 15 years, would be free next year to address them in his place. Observers say that hope is one of the most powerful reasons why Kurds remain committed to the peace process. Dorian Jones, FSRN, Diyarbakir, Southeast Turkey.
In the Chilean port city of Valparaiso, residents are starting to rebuild after massive fires killed 15 people and leveled nearly 3,000 homes this April. From Chile, Eilish O'Neill reports.
Residents in the neighborhoods burned down in April's fires are hard at work rebuilding their own homes. The signs of destruction are everywhere. The burnt skeletons of brick houses dot the streets. The wooden ravines between the populated hillsides are full of blackened, charred trees. And residents are living in emergency shelters.
Ahora está un poquito así porque están poniendo la luz.
Maria Isabel Celedon is one of those living in a government-built emergency shelter made of plywood and corrugated metal. It's just two rooms, a bedroom, and a larger space that serves as a dining room, living room, and kitchen. And Celedon still doesn't have a bathroom. She's sharing a portable toilet with several of her neighbors.
Me cuesta un poco.
Celedon says she was visiting her daughter in northern Chile when the fire broke out. And while thinking of that night still moves her to tears, she says the distance saved her from living the nightmare her neighbors and much of her family experienced. When she returned to Valparaiso, her house and everything in it were gone.
El incendio afectó a toda la parte de arriba de Valparaiso.
Carolina Moraes is an architect with expertise in public housing and energy-efficient homes. She's been volunteering in the neighborhoods that burned down in April to help families build new houses or improve their emergency settlements.
The fire affected the outlying parts of Valparaiso, the hilltops. And right now we're going to the place where people, it's like the newest part of the city, the shanty towns, the newly arrived families are very vulnerable. They live in very poor places. They had houses made of scrap material.
One of the neighborhoods where Carolina Moraes has been volunteering is the Cerro Ramaditas. Here, the people lived in informal, spontaneous settlements. Families built homes wherever they found space, on old timber plantations. The dry wood, lack of fire breaks and other urban planning, and the poor accessibility made for a lethal combination, says architect Rodolfo Jimenez of the University of Santiago.
No fueron lugares pensados.
These neighborhoods weren't planned. They were occupied by squatters, and they thus have serious problems of access, of services. It's very difficult for firefighters to get to these places or for there to be regular trash pickup. As a result, the ravines are full of garbage, and part of the combustible material was the trash that the residents themselves threw into the ravines.
Now, the government's trying to prevent those who lived in particularly high-risk locations from rebuilding in the same place.
A esas personas se les está notificando que tienen que abandonar esos lugares.
Valparaíso's urban planning secretary, Luis Paro Donoso, says many of those in the informal settlements are being told they need to leave. But the order to evacuate comes with the offer of aid.
Y se les están ofreciendo reubicarlo en otros terrenos que el Estado pueda disponer para ello.
Luis Paro says the government can help with relocation. It's already built emergency shelters for all of those who lost their homes, he adds. Now, it's helping people find permanent solutions by giving out subsidies, vouchers they can use to rebuild their homes, buy new homes, and rent apartments while they wait for their house to be ready. Paro adds that the government of Valparaíso is also planning to improve the city's infrastructure to help reduce the risk for future fires.
Our big investments in infrastructure and connectivity will allow people to get around more easily and will make fire prevention with fire trucks, police services, ambulances, everything more efficient. In addition, we're building a network of water pumps that will take advantage of the grade. That is, they will move potable water from the top of the hill to the bottom and not, as it currently does, move water up from the bottom of the hill.
But University of Santiago architect Rodolfo Jimenez says these infrastructure improvements, while important, don't go nearly far enough to renew the affected neighborhoods. He says the government should build more collective housing, such as small apartment buildings in keeping with Valparaíso's character, to free up space for parks, businesses, and places for recreation and community building.
Un barrio debiera tener equipamiento de todo tipo.
A neighborhood should have infrastructure of all kinds, for young people, for children, for mothers, recreational spaces. And today, because the hill was occupied spontaneously by squatters, that infrastructure doesn't exist.
Hoy día, dado que la forma en que se ha ocupado el cerro es una forma espontánea, no existen.
Without waiting for the government to act, architect Carolina Moraes is starting to address these issues. She's building playgrounds in the affected areas, and she's simultaneously teaching residents low-cost, energy-efficient techniques, such as covering their houses with adobe, that they can apply in their own homes. Isabel Celedón is one of the residents who learned these techniques from Moraes, and she's already stuccoed her emergency home with adobe to improve its insulation.
Hay que salir adelante.
Celedón says it's necessary to keep moving forward, and Valparaíso Planning Secretary Luis Paro agrees. He says all individual homes will be rebuilt within 2 years, while larger infrastructure projects will take at least 4 or 5 years to plan and execute. In the meantime, architects like Rodolfo Jimenez and Carolina Moraes are trying to fill in the gaps. Alicia O'Neill, FSRN, Valparaíso, Chile.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. For transcripts, audio, and photographs from the stories featured on today's program and more, please visit our website at fsrn.org. Technical support this week was provided by Robert Packard and Lewis Reining at WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Editorial services are provided by Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico. Music used in today's program is by Lena Selyanina. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.